The English Revolution broke out in 1640. At first, the conflict appeared to be among the kingdoms of Scotland, Ireland, and England, a contest for regional dominance and religious conformity. It was not long, however, before Parliament asserted its rights and powers against the personal and absolute rule of Charles I, introducing the slogan, "No taxation without representation," and expanding the writ of habeas corpus as an instrument of individual freedom against arbitrary imprisonment. Civil war pitted king, cavaliers, against parliament, roundheads. The creation of a new model army in 1645 resulted in a series of military victories for the parliamentary side. The increasingly successful revolutionaries did away with censorship of the press, abolished repressive courts such as the Star Chamber, where Bacon had once ruled, and executed King Charles I by decapitation in January 1649. They then dissolved the monarchy, and the House of Lords declared a republic. Oliver Cromwell and the militant Puritans led the revolutionary forces. The Atlantic merchants, lesser gentry, and nascent industrialists who tended to back Cromwell all gained much from the economic changes encouraged by the state. The Navigation Acts protected British trade and shipping. Agricultural enclosures privatized property. Industrial legislation removed production from paternal restrictions on profiteering. And financial alterations in the stock market and funded debt promoted speculative capitalism. English merchants moved decisively toward the African slave trade as sugar plantations, imported from Brazil, expanded throughout the West Indies. In making their revolution, Cromwell and his propertied allies had to rely upon the radical voices of the many-headed hydra, the levelers and the diggers, the soldiers and sailors, the urban riders and rural commoners, which proved to have an agenda of their own. The ideas of the radicals were eventually suppressed by Cromwell and his ilk, but they were nonetheless formative in their own day and later. That was from a book called The Many-Headed Hydra by Peter Linbaugh. Sailors, Slaves, Commoners, and the Hidden History of the Revolutionary Atlantic. Now, I wanted to bring up that not just because it's a good summary of the English Civil War, which is the backdrop of the main poem by Anne Bradstreet we're discussing, but also because that poem uses the many-headed hydra image. We'll get to that later. Welcome to Literary Hangover. I'm your host, Matt Leck. With me, Alex Guns.
Hello.
Today, we are talking about Anne Bradstreet, who is sort of the first definitely female poet in America, and somebody that, you know, I'll be honest, I had heard of. This isn't like a Catherine Maria Sedgwick scenario where I'd heard of her, but the story that I'd heard of her was fairly reductive. It was, she had some poems published against her will, and here's a poem about how she was embarrassed by that, and she has a poem about how her house burnt down, and isn't that very 17th century? Alex, what's your knowledge of Anne Bradstreet?
Sadly, zero. Nothing until you suggested her.
Oh, nice.
We were talking about the next person, and you were like, I think you were saying that we should do that poet that wasn't really published but wrote extensively. I'm like, oh, you mean Emily Dickinson? You know, like trying to subtly own you. And then you turned it right back on me and revealed that it's actually someone who I had never even heard of.
Yeah, that's what you get for trying to own me in poetry.
Yeah.
But so who was Anne? She was born in 1612 in England to a fairly wealthy family. In fact, her father, Thomas Dudley, came over along with Anne on the Arbella, which was the ship that John Winthrop himself came over. And Dudley was, in fact, one of Winthrop's right-hand men, and himself, Dudley, would go on to be governor of the whole Massachusetts Bay colonies, I think, four times. And so basically Anne comes from politically powerful family, which is not very surprising when you think of what it... I wonder what the exchange rate would be for a piece of paper to compose poetry on. Like, it's probably not an iPad, but like maybe a DVD. Like, every time you buy a piece of paper, you're basically buying a DVD, so you better put some good words on that.
Well, just, I mean, the leisure time to, one, compose, and two, read beforehand to be inspired to compose.
Right.
Especially in a colonial environment, betrays like a pretty high level of comfort, I would imagine.
And in fact, Anne's father encouraged her to be studious when she was younger. And we'll discuss later, Anne published and composed, I guess, not published, that'd be the wrong word, composed a lot during the cycles of birth, because she had a number of children. I'm not sure exactly how many, but she was basically pregnant for decades at a time, or pregnant and recovering from pregnancies. She came to the U.S. in 1630, like I said, with her father, Thomas, on the Arbella, and her husband, who is also a man of distinction. But before we go any further with Anne Bradstreet, it's important to talk about another Massachusetts Bay Anne Hutchinson. And we have we've been sort of teasing the Hutchinson discussion for a while now. And I do want to retract what I said earlier about a little bit of a side eye, I think, I extended toward Anne Hutchinson, mainly because of, in one of the books I read, it stressed the part about her talking directly to God. And I thought that was a bit wonky. However, if the contention is instead that she has as much of an ability to hear the voice of God as preachers do, then I agree with that. So I think I was unfair about Anne. Basically, Anne Hutchinson, she comes over in 1634, so a little bit after, 4 years after Anne Bradstreet, and she's coming for John Cotton's preaching. God apparently told her to follow John Cotton. So she's sort of a super fan of John Cotton. Yeah, I mean, maybe
a roadie.
Maybe the English Civil War and sort of the sectarian battles have something to do with that, with encouraging. I don't think she was just like a big Justin Bieber fan for John Cotton, not Tom Cotton. But I wonder if there's a relation there, because Tom Cotton also went to Harvard.
That would be fitting.
But she comes over to the New World, and immediately she starts becoming like a midwife, but also one that's extremely versed in spiritual matters, which makes her very popular.
And willing to share that information too.
Yeah, exactly, especially with women. The problem is she's not going to the sort of remedial Bible study courses, and instead she starts setting up her own little like breakdowns and, I guess, you know, like Talking Dead with the Walking Dead. Like, she's doing commentaries. She's yeah, almost like the first podcaster.
Yeah. She's shit posting.
Yeah. But she's doing it in a very private forum. It's like a WhatsApp group. And the men don't really...
This makes sense.
Yeah. The men don't really like that. I guess we should maybe just play some of this. A book that I've been really, really enjoying called Mistress Bradstreet, The Untold Life of America's First Poet. This is by Charlotte Gordon. It's one of the best biographies of a literary figure that I've read since I've read this project. It's just really, really gives you a feel of what the life was like in colonial Massachusetts. Covers a lot of the figures that you want, or that we've sort of discussed. It talks about, there's a good section on Morton and his silly, sort of Maypole and Marymount shenanigans. There's a good section on, well, like, we're going to see Hutchinson, and there's a good section on Hutchinson that explains sort of why a little bit later Anne Bradstreet will have to be a bit careful in how she publishes her poetry to the world.
Dudley had taught his daughters that it was their duty to report to him or to their husbands anything that seemed unusual or that contradicted the godly mission of the colonists.
Dudley is Anne's father.
It was everyone's job to know what everyone else was doing. In Plymouth, for example, members of that settlement's governing board, the grand jury, were required to scrutinize people's behavior on a daily basis, scouring the streets for idleness and other evils occasioned thereby and hauling any wrongdoers straight into court. Sin was infectious, and unpunished bad behavior could bring about everyone's destruction. The state of your conscience was never solely a personal affair but was also a civic matter. Ironically, though, it was because of the aspersions against her piety and the criticism she faced for not attending these meetings that Hutchinson began to hold gatherings for women in her house. How else could she disprove the reports that she did despise all the rules and customs, the ordinances, of Boston? Or so she would argue a few years later when called to account for her actions. At first Hutchinson's meetings were small, maybe 5 or 6 women, and were dedicated to studying the Bible and discussing Cotton's sermons. But they rapidly mushroomed into gatherings of 60 or more. In the few months she had been in the colonies, Hutchinson had helped deliver numerous infants and had buoyed their mothers with her stalwart faith. She had also proven herself to be a fruitful vine in her own right, having borne 11 children. Clearly she had important lessons to teach, and women of all ages flocked to her side. But to her discomfited neighbor, John Winthrop, it seemed that she kept open house for all comers, and set up 2 lecture days in the week, when they usually met at her house 60 or 40 persons, that winter the Boston men watched with growing concern as their wives trooped down the dirt lane and turned the corner to the Hutchinsons' homestead. No male could be certain what went on at these meetings that most people called gossipings, the conventional term for such female gatherings. Each time a good wife entered the dark cave of Mrs. Hutchinson's home, the door was effectively slammed in the face of her husband. The sort of female gossiping that the Bay Colony men were beginning to suspect occurred in Hutchinson's house loomed as a danger because their settlement depended on neighborliness. If women were prone to wandering about from house to house, the men worried they would speak a things which they ought not, as Paul wrote in a frequently quoted passage from the New Testament. Such female scolds, their critics held, relished trouble because they wanted to make debate abroad and would never be able to resist the temptation to announce their husband's flaws for all the town to hear. To speak in public like this to publish was to usurp the role of men and trespass into a world where a woman did not belong. Such masculine women buried silence to revive slander. Women's gossip, if uncontrolled and left unchecked, could render the speakers deformed, manlike, and even monstrous. 22. To the anxious male leaders in Boston and Newtown, this seemed the grotesque direction in which Mrs. Hutchinson and her followers were headed.
I just love how regular this sort of information control and sort of panic at, oh shit, we don't have control over this, how often that comes up, right? Like, mm-hmm. A lot of books that I've read on this time do stress how actual much force women's the sort of discourse had, a privileged discourse. And you know, they also make a point about during childbirth, the men just have to leave the houses entirely, and it's just a female domain. And basically, gossip was the only, or one of the main collective weapons that women had against the men of the time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the Puritan Project was a rather new project at the time, and they took their role in the world extremely seriously, which is they were going to make the world new again, starting in this extremely small outgrowth in the new world. And for someone like Anne Hutchinson, who wasn't necessarily aggressive in her attacks on the Puritan church in New England, but she did say that she disagreed with the idea that they're teaching a works-based salvation, which is like you can be saved through doing X, Y, and Z on earth. Mm-hmm. They would probably disagree with her because that was a major bone of contention between the Protestants and the Catholics during the Reformation. And a forming principle was that grace is given, or a forming principle for Puritans was that grace is given freely by God. It's not, you can't do anything to change its mind, basically. But Anne Hutchinson took it to a much more, returned it to a much more Calvinist direction, where her thing was that the elect were chosen before birth to go to heaven, and I can see who the elect are, and I am one of them. Which is always always the caveat for anyone who wants to lead a new spiritual movement. So that's where it started pushing it over the edge. And then with allowing women to discourse on the Bible, they're like, we've got to put a stop to this shit.
Yeah, the works and deeds thing, it's always been a bit inscrutable to me, although I'm understanding it a bit better in the context of colonial America, where literally like most of these people have been through a winter where they had way too little to eat. And when you're at the sort of mercy of nature like this, and death can be a very real part of life, especially with regards to having children, all of those outcomes apparently have nothing to do with what you have done. But the thing that's crazy to me, and we're going to get into this some more with Anne, who basically takes her, Anne Bradstreet, who basically takes her successful births as confirmation that her poetry is good and okay with God. On the way over, there's an interesting class mixing element to the boat ride. There's a day, I believe I remember this correctly, where the weather isn't very good. I don't know if it's some kind of ill-omened wind or something. And the way that the leaders react to that is to say, all right, who's been sinning? Right? Like, and then some guys are like, yeah, I guess we stole some beer. And then they get punished. And it's like, oh, look at the weather. It's great.
I thought of a woman yesterday.
Yeah. And I don't want to draw anything too concrete about this, but it does remind me of certain things like, when things are going poorly, you assign blame. The instinct is to assign blame to something that's irritating you, even if that might not be the most important thing. Like, Like, let's say, like, your boat's going down, right? And somebody's doing something kind of annoying, like maybe chewing gum really loudly. Or, like, stop chewing that fucking gum.
Yeah.
It's just what the most immediate available annoyance is. And you deal with that as if that's, and as if, like, that is going to solve the broader problems of, like, we don't have enough food for the winter. I don't know. Let's skip a bit forward to where Anne Hutchinson is actually going to be put on trial for some of the things she's saying about the leadership in New England.
As the days grew bitter and short, both sides prepared for the trial. Simon and Dudley removed to Newtown, where business ground to a halt as deputies and delegates piled into the rectangular meeting house, the only structure big enough to hold such a gathering. For Anne, who was well advanced in her third pregnancy, it was out of the question to travel such a long distance simply to be a spectator. And she was not alone. For most women living in remote towns, it must have been frustrating to know that such momentous events were occurring out of their immediate reach. They would have to wait for the men to return home to tell them what had happened. It would be difficult, though, for most observers, including Simon and Dudley, to describe with any real accuracy the drama to come or the woman at its center. Dudley declared, "Mistress Hutchinson, from that time she came, hath made a disturbance." 21 Winthrop, who had been re-elected governor that spring, now called Mistress Hutchinson the breeder and nourisher of all these distempers, illustrating his conviction that she was a woman gone wrong, having misused her maternal abilities so grievously. 22. On that opening day in November, however, Mrs. Hutchinson appeared fearless and easily overturned the magistrate's reasoning with her own biblical references. When Winthrop demanded to know the reason behind the large meetings at her house, she asked with cutting politeness, "May not I entertain them that fear the Lord because my parents will not give me leave?" Understanding the system in which she lived, Hutchinson did not contest the paternal authority of the court directly. Instead, her use of the double negative suggested that there was a higher law than that of the court and she was simply adhering to God's commandments. Her flustered listeners could not come up with a scriptural refutation of her point, and so Winthrop attempted to smooth this over by exclaiming, "We do not mean to discourse argue with those of your sex," in the hopes that a reminder of her subordinate status as a woman would lessen the power of her logic. Still, her point hung in the air, unrefuted.
He tries to go ad hominem on her.
Yeah.
Winthrop's spluttering retort notwithstanding, this was exactly what the trial was predicated on, formal and public debate with a female, a radical event, since women were by definition not meant to inhabit the realm of governmental or church authority. The very proceedings, then, threatened to upset colonial definitions of the proper code of behavior, particularly if the magistrates did not win. The pressure was on for both sides, therefore, although there was little chance that the magistrates would lose their case, since they significantly outnumbered the Boston contingent of Hutchinson supporters. Still, the Bostonians were powerful and vociferous and would certainly kick up even more chaos if they felt that injustice had been perpetrated. As for Anne Hutchinson, she knew she was fighting not only for her dignity and integrity but for her life. The prospect of exile hung in the air like a death sentence. With such high stakes, the opponents were vigilantly attuned to any sign of weakness on the part of the other. Of course, the magistrates had the advantage because they could spell each other and lend their colleagues moral support, whereas the 46-year-old Hutchinson stood in isolation, facing them on her own and arguing her case out of sheer willpower, intelligence, and faith. Her strength was all the more astonishing as she was pregnant and would, in fact, collapse at the end of this first day of questioning. As the trial ensued, it seemed she had carefully prepared her arguments before the trial, or else she was so conversant with the Bible that her answers flew off the tip of her tongue. She rarely hesitated, and spoke quickly, without the need to consult notes. For example, when the court asked her to justify the meetings at her house, she replied promptly and used the Bible to support her actions, citing Titus 2:3-5, which spoke of the godliness of elder women preaching to younger ones, and a story in Acts, where a godly woman named Priscilla, accompanied by her husband, instructed a young man in the ways of Christ. The court could not refute these passages, and Winthrop could only bluster angrily, "You show us not a rule." Hutchinson responded with admirable calm, "I have given you two places of scripture." To this the discomfited governor exclaimed, "But neither of them will suit your practice." With what might have been an audible snort, Hutchinson said in a mockery of their literal mindedness, "Must I show my name written therein?"
That reminds me of a Christopher Hitchensism. That says the fight we face is that between the literal versus the ironic mind. The latter, ironic, being the preferable to the literal, because often when a literal mindedness will just interpret a text, for instance, like the Bible, to mean what the powers that be mean it want it to mean, basically. Mm-hmm. But man, Hutchinson is she's a very impressive martyr to freedom of thought and expression. Mm-hmm. Like, pretty amazing stuff, I think.
Yeah, even if she didn't, I feel like she gets bundled up a little bit with freedom of religion, which like a lot of these people of that time do, which is, you know, she wasn't necessarily a proponent of you do you and I'll do me. She was like, I'm correct.
Yeah.
But there is something admirable in a person who's being taken advantage of in society to stand up for themselves, even in the face of death.
And with their, by their own logic.
Yeah, right? Yeah.
She tries to buy their own logic. And it turns out like that's not really, today, it's not really about the logic. It's about the muscle and you and whose army.
Yeah. Basically. It's like professional ethics or whatever the hell, being like, it doesn't actually matter.
Yeah. So yeah, I'm very impressed. I love that response to the literalness. Like, what do I need to find my name in the Bible you to be happy? Like, I'm crushing you guys right now.
Yeah, yeah.
Have you even read the Bible? This is like, I'm a woman and I'm killing you.
I have given you two places of scripture. To this the discomfited governor exclaimed, but neither of them will suit your practice. With what might have been an audible snort, Hutchinson said in a mockery of their literal-mindedness, must I show my name written therein? But although the mistress was triumphing in this battle of wits, her successes were only further alienating her enemies. Each of her competent references to scripture and her very confidence only made it more evident to her enemies that she was trespassing in male territory. She should not be so well versed.
It tells you about all you need to know about the place of women in society now. So, and Bradstreet, more, you know, I guess, come from a slightly higher level in the social status. She's witnessing all this, but she never writes specifically about it. She never comes down to one way or the other, but she did take lessons from it, and here are some of those lessons.
Given the dangers, politically speaking, of a woman's being so outspoken, these were especially inflammatory words. Not that Anne meant to retroactively support the Hutchinson revolution that had almost taken place. But the raft of misogynist complaints that had been unleashed in response to the Hutchinson crisis must have troubled her. She knew better, however, than to declare her ideas out loud. Only under the cover of night, while the town slept, did she venture to assert her own frank arguments. These writing times were few and far between, as Anne was often too exhausted to stay up after the children were asleep. If it was hard for anyone to find time alone in colonial New England, it was doubly hard for a young mother. By the time she had written the poem to Elizabeth, Anne had borne five children. To embark on a journey as a writer was such an implausible undertaking that even she must have sometimes wondered why she spent her energy this way. But each of her early poems was not only an attempt to sort through the difficulties she experienced as a woman writer but also her response to the hardship of her life. When it began to leak out that she was composing poetry in the dead of night, she reported the whispers of those who believed that she was overstepping her place. I am obnoxious to each carping tongue slash who says my hand a needle better fit. Buoyed by the education she had received as a child as well as by her father's belief in her poetic vocation, she felt she could best serve the colony through her literary efforts. She also seemed to understand that to survive her life in the wilderness, she had to focus on her intellectual well-being as well as the exigencies of daily life. She had more success than her contemporary in walking this thin line. Anne would be praised for maintaining her exact diligence in her place, while Hutchinson would be pilloried for generations for her various trespasses. In fact, ironically, Mistress Hutchinson's downfall ushered in the most fertile decade of Anne Bradstreet's life, fertile in every sense of the word. From 1638 to 1648, Anne wrote more than 6,000 lines of poetry, more than almost any other English writer on either side of the Atlantic composed in an entire lifetime. For most of this time, she was either pregnant, recovering from childbirth, or nursing an infant, establishing herself as a woman blessed by God, the highest commendation a New England Puritan mother could receive. Once Anne had settled into the rhythm of bearing children, babies seemed to stimulate her work. Perhaps this was because Anne had found reliable servants to help her take care of the house and to tend the little ones, helpful. But it was also probably no accident that these two kinds of creative activities went hand in hand for her. Rather than viewing children as an obstacle to a productive working life, Puritan parents saw each child as an asset to the family's blessings and wealth. The more hands, the lighter the labor, the more healthy Puritan children who came of age in America, the greater the chances of longevity for the English colony, and so it was everyone's responsibility to have as many children as possible and to instruct them in the ways of Puritanism. To Anne, each new baby was also an incentive to be a good pious mother, and her poetry became part of her attempt to teach her children the tenets of her religion. In 1638, just months after Mrs. Hutchinson's exile, Anne bore her third baby, a healthy little girl. Poor Mrs. Hutchinson, however, had suffered a catastrophe. Driven out of Boston when she was pregnant and forced to give birth in the wilderness, she had produced a horribly damaged infant, or so rumors claimed. Some people even whispered that Hutchinson's child was not human but a demon fathered by Satan. That Hutchinson had borne such a deformity was a dreadful testimony to her sinful nature, according to the stern beliefs of New Englanders. To them a woman's womb proved her virtue and piety or demonstrated her hypocrisies. Before her trial, Hutchinson had risen to power in part because she was seen as a virtuous mother. After her guilt was proven, it fit Puritan logic that she would no longer be favored by God. If each child was a physical manifestation of the mother's spiritual condition, then, as the minister Thomas Weld argued, see how the wisdom of God fitted this judgment to her Hutchinson's sin every way, for Lucas she had vented misshapen opinions, so she must bring forth deformed monsters.
So yeah, people talk about how mean and toxic social media is. this is, I mean, that is a very, we're going to exile you. And rumor is, none of us really know for sure, but you had a kid that is maybe Satan. So maybe you should think about, you know, having those Bible studies.
Yeah, you should think twice before having a disabled child.
That's the environment that Anne Bradstreet is writing in. Now let's go to what was eventually published in 1650, but what she was composing over the course of this time. It was published as The Tenth Muse, lately sprung up. It has a very long name, actually. Maybe I should just read the whole thing. This is that thing about how early publishing, they used to put basically every detail you would need to know in the title to make sure you would buy it if you wanted to.
When they ripped the first page off or something?
Basically,
and use it as a poster?
Yeah, it became like a handbill, yeah.
Yeah.
What it's known by, the short title is, The Tenth Muse Lately Sprung Up in America. The full name is, The Tenth Muse Lately Sprung Up in America, or several poems compiled with a great variety of wit and learning, full of delight, wherein especially is contained a complete discourse and description of the four elements, constitutions, ages of man, seasons of the year, together with an exact epitome of the four monarchies, viz., the Assyrian, Persian, Grecian, Roman, also a dialogue between Old England and New concerning the late troubles, with diverse other pleasant and serious poems by a gentlewoman in those parts. Now,
what's not to like, right?
Yeah,
there?
It is great.
It's something for everyone.
Yeah, the branding folks really came through at that one.
You like history? Great, because we have every kind of monarch. You don't like that? You just like seasons? Boom, got that too.
Now, it does come clean that it was by a gentlewoman in those parts. The name, The Tenth Muse, was sort of meant to distract a little bit from that. Like, these poems are coming from a muse, not a female poet. Later, she would publish it under several poems, and it wouldn't have that sort of rhetorical lessening of the sort of origin of these poems.
Well, also, the Tenth Muses was the nomenclature for Sappho, the ancient Greek poet, female poet on the Isle of Lesbos, and she had been in the canon since the beginning. So I feel like the publisher and some fashion as being like, there have been lady poets.
Yeah, right. And so we should talk about the publishing for this a little bit. Like I said, published in 1650 by Anne's brother-in-law, who took the manuscripts. Reverend John Woodbridge took it to London, and I'll read from the Wikipedia here because it's a little bit wrong. Published purportedly without Bradstreet's knowledge, Bradstreet wrote to her publisher acknowledging that is that right? It was Bradstreet's only work published in her lifetime. Published purportedly without Bradstreet's knowledge, Bradstreet wrote to her publisher acknowledging that she knew of the publication. She was forced to pretend she was unaware of the publication until afterwards, or she would have risked harsh criticism. Bradstreet wrote the author to her book in 1606 when a second edition was contemplated. So there's a line that kind of contradicts what the other line is, which is, you know, what happens when you write a Wikipedia by a committee. The intro ends, the book was published without Bradstreet's knowledge by Reverend John Woodbridge. There's a couple things here. Anne may or may not have known exactly what Woodbridge was going to do in terms of publishing it for public consumption, but she absolutely had the expectation that these poems would be shared among a sort of elite poetry reading, like the, you shared a manuscript with people. There's
like salon culture.
Exactly. And so like there's cases of poets after their house burns down, they'll ask one of their associates, hey, do you have a copy of that poem that I sent you? You know, not, again, not cheap to make copies of poems, but would also mean that they would probably save it and remember it. But so her brother-in-law takes it there, takes it to England, and then publishes it in 1650. This is after Charles's head's been cut off, if I am getting this right, I'm pretty sure. But it was written in 1642, right at the start of the English Civil War. So that is, I mean, for somebody who didn't know Anne Bradstreet had political writings, it can't really get much more political, and that's what sort of blew my mind about that. But before we go any further into the more political writing, let's talk about the prologue and maybe listen to it. This comes from the Michael Jordan of LibriVox, Elizabeth Klett. Although this isn't actually on LibriVox. This is just on archive.org.
I thought it was that old guy who... That's so mean. The older guy who does who did like Maypole and things like that.
The
like,
Maypole of Marymount. Yeah, that guy is, he's the Kareem Abdul-Jabbar.
Wow.
Of LibriVox. And so yeah, this is the prologue by Anne Bradstreet, and we're gonna hear a lot of hints of her sensitivity to what Anne Hutchinson went through. I think
the prologue. To sing of wars, of captains, and of kings, of cities founded, commonwealths begun. For my mean pen are two superior things. Or how they all, or each, their dates have run, let poets and historians set these forth. My obscure lines shall not so dim their worth.
So like I said, she's building up some humility here. Like, historians and poets, they can do these things better. Don't really expect me to be awesome here. So lower expectations.
Well, and also in the opening, she immediately invokes the power of the muses, which is that's bedrock Western literary tradition, whether it's the Aeneid with Virgil calling in the help of the nine muses. To explain this epic tale,
right.
Or where he pulled that from Homer, both in the Iliad and the Odyssey, calls upon the muses to come down, and it's theorized that when the epic poems of Homer, these are musical performances and done by memory, and you know, people who were able to do like 800, 900 lines at a time. So before that, they would invoke the muses to help them in this incredibly like. Almost like long distance sprint of a performance.
Yeah, I'm glad you brought that up because it reminds me of Alexander Pope's The Dunciad, which is one mm-hmm. of my favorite poems. It's a very long satire in the style of it's a mock epic. The first lines are the mighty mother and her son who brings the Smithfield muses to the ear of kings. So yeah, exactly right.
But when my wondering eyes and envious heart, great Bartis' sugared lines do but read o'er, fool, I do grudge the muses did not part twixt him and me that overfluent store. A Bartis can do what a Bartis will, but simple I, according to my skill.
Bartis is one of her key influences.
From schoolboys' tongues no rhetoric we expect, nor yet a sweet consort from broken strings, nor perfect beauty wears a main defect. My foolish, broken, blemished muse so sings. And this to mend, alas, no art is able, cause nature made it so irreparable. Nor can I, like that fluent, sweet-tongued Greek, who lisped at first, in future times speak plain. By art he gladly found what he did seek, a full requital of his striving pain. Art can do much, but this maxim's most sure. A weak or wounded brain admits no cure.
Now here's where we get to the more focused gender stuff.
I am obnoxious to each carping tongue, who says my hand a needle better fits. A poet's pen all scorn I should thus wrong, for such despite they cast on female wits. If what I do prove well, it won't advance. They'll say it's stolen. Or else it was by chance.
A lot of anxiety of influence here. She's already mentioned Bartus, and she talks about, you know, you're just gonna, if this is good, you're just gonna say I stole it from somewhere.
And stole it from a man, obviously. Mm-hmm. She's getting into that and political statement.
She's also had two references to pens, and that was a very common penis wordplay, basically. Mm-hmm.
And then she's references a Greek orator with a lisp. That's Demosthenes, and he was... It's like a public, and we'll say he's like the Christopher Hitchens of the is of Athenian place, of the Agora. Mm. But he had a lisp and he was able to get over it and convince people to join his political cause.
But sure, the antique Greeks were far more mild. Else of Arsax, why feigned they those nine, and poesy made Calliope's own child? So, amongst the rest, they placed the arts divine. But this weak knot they will full soon untie. The Greeks did naught but play the fools and lie. Let Greeks be Greeks, and women what they are. Men have precedency, and still excel. It is but vain unjustly to wage war. Men can do best, and women know it well. Preeminence in all and each is yours. Yet grant some small acknowledgement of ours.
That's an amazing stanza. Like, mm-hmm. guys, we're not going to completely... We know you're the best. We know men are just so much more capable. But let us have a little bit.
Yeah. I love that it opens with her fully Hellenized, being like, ah, yes, like the muses come down to me. And even sprinkling in references to, not obscure Greeks, but something you would have to have a pretty... serviceable knowledge of Greek history to know what she's talking about.
These aren't just Bible verses.
Yeah, exactly. And then for her in that stanza to be like, let the Greeks actually, they're not that great. And actually, like, why don't you just let them be them, which is dead, mm-hmm. and let me mm-hmm. be me, which is a living poet.
A living poet that's in a new world too, yes. right? Yeah. All right. One more stanza on this one.
And oh, ye high-flown quills that soar the skies, and ever with your prey still catch your praise, if e'er you deign these lowly lines your eyes, give thyme or parsley wreath. I ask no bays. This mean and unrefined ore of mine will make your glistering gold but more to shine.
Yeah, so I think that's a very, as far as... you know, a prologue to the first bit of poetry written by a woman... That is covers a lot of bases there.
You know, we talked a lot on previous episodes about like self-consciously myth-making in the American story, right? And like, I like to contrast it with like the Aeneid, which was the probably the best example of like Rome telling its story at the peak of its power, going back and being like, this is how we started. We were always great. Right. And the American writers that like, if we look at like The Spy or something like that, immediately after the founding events, they're like, we need to mythologize this right away. Whereas this poem is something that's not self-consciously myth-making. And yet to me seems a much more apt and appropriate poem for looking at like the bedrock of the American story and like the like American literary movement, mm-hmm. because she invokes the muses like it's going to be this like she's about to go off on this like grand epic tale of love, loss, and betrayal. But then she's like, I'm actually just a lowly woman, and then she shrinks it back down to like just not this person at the center of the world, but this kind of this woman who's almost just writing to herself, expecting no audience. But then her call is to something even much larger than Homer or Virgil could have imagined, which is to all like the women of the world, that you all can be poets.
Yeah. I think we'll go into it here. Basically this, why her sort of horizons are enlarged has a lot to do with this deputy husband concept that comes up where the man of the house is gone, so the wife has to basically take over the husband role. This is just a bit of an intro on not only to the a dialogue between Old England and New, which is going to be the main poem that we're discussing today, but also this sort of development of Anne's sort of, I guess, husband qualities.
A full-fledged violent conflict loomed between Charles and his subjects. By the summer, both sides had put an end to negotiations and began to prepare for armed conflict. About halfway through her fifth pregnancy, Anne brooded over the future. No one knew what might happen to Massachusetts Bay. It seemed an inauspicious time to bring an infant into the world. On July 21, Winthrop and Dudley responded to the crisis in England by calling for a fast day. Like Ward, most people in the colony still nurtured a traditional loyalty to the king even though they disapproved of many of his actions. He was the ruler and standard-bearer of the English people. How could there be an England without a monarch? Besides, it was unpleasant to consider how Charles might punish Puritans in general and Massachusetts in particular once he regained control of the government.
Sure, just to touch on the complaints here, basically Charles wanted money from Parliament, and they're like, we don't want to give it to you. And he's like, well, I don't want to let you have Parliament then. And
honest argument.
Yeah, I mean, this is better covered in the Revolutions podcast by yes. Mike Duncan, which I would recommend you, if you want a bit more background in what this revolution is like, check that out. But I do find it interesting that the no taxation without representation thing, which is going to be a big big thing in between America and England, is key here.
Britons in general and Massachusetts in particular once he regained control of the government. For of course he would, after all, he was the king. That fall, news came that New Englanders' forebodings were coming true. Back in August, the king had fled from the capital. Parliament howled that Charles must be returned to them immediately by battle or other way. 22 Although at first it seemed that Charles had few supporters and could easily be cowed into submission, royalists mustered their forces and began to march on London. The reports broke off at this point, so when Anne went into labor, she could only picture the worst, the demise of Puritanism in England and America. Happily, Anne delivered another healthy baby, little Hannah, and perhaps she derived some comfort from the new infant's plump legs and tiny face. But while Anne suckled Hannah, more bad news sailed across the Atlantic. Guns had been fired. Englishmen had killed Englishmen. The king's forces had trounced the parliamentary army at Banbury on October 23. A civil war had begun. Anne seems to have been frustrated at waiting helplessly to receive more news. No longer simply interested in her own ambition or, for that matter, in showing the world that pious women could read, write, and think for themselves, Anne's ideas about her identity as a poet had enlarged. This elevation of purpose seems to have occurred in part because of her relationship with the politically minded Ward, but also because
Ward is the minister of the community there.
Of her role as a deputy husband in Ipswich had enlarged. This elevation of purpose seems to have occurred in part because of her relationship with the politically minded Ward, but also because of her role as a deputy husband in Ipswich. Over the last decade, she had been increasingly pushed into public matters as a prominent citizen of the town. She longed to rattle her spear against corruption and heresy like a man, and from watching Ward, she saw that the pen could serve as a redoubtable weapon. It was true that she couldn't write laws, but she could still write verse, and this verse could be political, angry, and manly in tone, even if she was only a woman. Cooped up indoors but fully recovered from the birth of her new baby, Anne was ready to launch herself into her new work. The poem she planned was longer than any of her earlier attempts. She would have to chant the lines to herself over and over, storing her ambitious work in her mind, since parchment was so scarce. But faced with the deadening hardship of daily life, nothing was probably more helpful for warding off despair, boredom, and a sense of purposelessness than the endless mental activity of composing, revising, and memorizing. In fact, the process was akin to prayer, just as her father had once taught her. But unlike male poets of the time...
That interested me. I'd never made the connection between prayer and poetry before. My general take on why poetry disappeared is just because you didn't need to be so succinct. That was is a media economics argument. But I do think falling out of a prayerful mindset, because poetry is, like, prayers are often, you know, I don't know if they always rhyme, but, you know, I mean, a similar sort of idea of memorizing prayers. They mentioned the catechism at this time was 45,000 words long that children had to memorize. And this to me is this is not how our brains work with text anymore. I think probably for the better, but it makes me think like maybe we don't have the brains to write poetry like this anymore. What do you think?
It's interesting. I'm always a little suspicious of just how influential poetry was at the time that it was being, the time that it was being written and published, and how you chart inspiration. I think it's probably undeniable that, like, as part of literary discourse, poetry, contemporary poetry, has taken a backseat in the latter half of the 20th century up to now. I'm not as confident in the reasons as to why, because I'm a big reader of poetry, but I don't necessarily have the history grasped. I don't know. It could have easily gone through ebbs and flows.
Right.
But I like yours. I'll subscribe to yours for now.
Well, I just like that image of her in her house reciting the poems.
The endless mental.
Reciting the poems that she's working on. I personally do not have that sort of open free time, just mentally, right? Like, I'm always like consuming something. Like, I've got a podcast or music going. That relationship with language, which is going to be me and the words I can think of tonight. I kind of miss that. It reminds me of like writing in creative writing classes a little bit, but there's something very romantic to me about that.
I do think you have to tie like the idea of poetry not as something to be cloistered away and read and thought over, but as to be spoken and disseminated amongst a group of people. The fact that that seems to have gone away, I think, explains why poetry as a force, a printed force, has been decimated.
Right.
Since parchment was so scarce, but faced with the deadening hardship of daily life, nothing was probably more helpful for warding off despair, boredom, and a sense of purposelessness than the endless mental activity of composing, revising, and memorizing. In fact, the process was akin to prayer, just as her father had once taught her. But unlike male poets of the time, Anne came up with her lines as she rocked her baby to sleep in the middle of the night, as she stirred the soup on the fire, or as she bathed a child's cut. And so, as she turned her attention to the martial poem she wanted to write, she again decided not to underplay her identity as a woman but to put it to good use. The idea must have flashed into her mind with the glitter of a gem. The poem would feature two characters, a mother, who represented Old England, and a daughter, who personified New England. Through their dialogue, Anne would find an opportunity to display her impressive knowledge of English history and politics and also fight for the Puritan side of the argument. Old England would wail, and her daughter would try to ease her suffering. But they would also argue a situation that must have been all too familiar to this headstrong daughter of the stern and traditional Dorothy. Not to mention that she now had three lively girls of her own who must have frequently challenged her rule of the house.
All right, so that is your intro to A Dialogue Between Old England and New by Anne Bradstreet, where she goes into the English Civil War in poetry form. Are you ready to start this poem?
Let's light it up.
All right. This is again by Elizabeth Klett, the god. although she does make a major mistake in her reading in one line that basically changes the entire meaning of it, and we will discuss that.
We'll get her, don't worry.
So we're going to take you down. This is like going after MJ for gambling. I don't know what my...
Michael Jordan is on the mind.
Basketball is really on the mind. Yeah. I was watching Zion Williamson highlights the other night, and very good ball player. All right, so here we go. Elizabeth Klett, A Dialogue Between Old England and New, written in 1642, published in 1650.
A dialogue between Old England and New, concerning their present troubles, in the year 1642. New England. Alas, dear mother.
I just want to say, sorry for starting right, stopping it right as it started here, but starts with New England. New England gets the first line, I think probably because very evidently Anne puts herself in the New England position. It does go into history a lot, though, in the remaining stanzas where you can see Anne misses her home and she has some sort of after she arrived in America, she never set foot on a boat again. She did not like that. But she was a big fan of, she was obviously still very connected to England, and at least... It's not super evident in this poem, but the idea that you need to still be loyal to the king, even though he's letting Catholics and
if you can imagine that.
Bribers in the state. But anyway, I digress. We'll go back to this year.
A dialogue between Old England and New, concerning their present troubles, in the year 1642. New England. Alas. Dear mother, fairest queen and best, with honour, wealth, and peace, happy and blessed, what ails thee? Hang thy head and cross thine arms, and sit in the dust to sigh these sad alarms. What deluge of new woes thus overwhelms the glories of thy ever-famous realm? What means this wailing tone, this mournful guise? Ah, tell thy daughter, she may sympathize.
I just, one quick note is the what we heard earlier from Mistress Bradstreet in the impatience for information makes this dialogue setting like it's a cross-transatlantic dialogue. That is an interesting frame for me to put it on.
Old England. Art ignorant indeed of these my woes, or must my forced tongue these griefs disclose, and must myself dissect my tattered state, which amazed Christendom stands wondering at?
That's like the, we used to be the city on a hill. And
we
now
used to make things in this country.
Yeah, exactly. And now everyone's looking at it like, everyone's laughing at us.
I think, I like the idea of having a mother and a daughter meet each other at the opening of this poem, and neither of them is reading each other the way they want to be read. Mm. Where the younger one saying, like, I'm here to console you. Why haven't you spoken to me yet? And the mother is like, I can't even begin with you. How am I supposed to tell you of what my daughter, of all people, what's wrong with me?
Yeah, the end of the stanza is very funny to think of in a social media context. Let's continue a little bit here.
And thou, a child, a limb, and dost not feel my fainting, weakened body now to reel? This physic purging potion I have taken will bring consumption, or an ague quaking, unless some cordial thou fetch from high, which present help may ease my malady. If I decease, dost think thou shalt survive, or by my wasting state dost think to thrive? Then weigh our case, if it be not justly sad. Let me lament alone, while thou art glad.
So these lines, 19 through 22, were the ones that were my ears perked up, and why I decided to, we're just going to do this. Because if I deceased, dost think thou shalt survive, or by my wasting state dost think to thrive? Like that, as a summation of the relationship between America and Britain, is very interesting. And then then weigh our case, if not be justly sad, let me lament alone while thou art glad. Like, mm-hmm. Just let me cry. You're enjoying yourself.
Yeah, yeah.
Not a care in the world.
And it's not a matter for you because you're a child. I think the child is trying to assert itself, being like, our relationship is the same. You're still my parent. But I'm not as young as you may think I am.
Yeah, I'm not just blowing bubbles and doing all the other many fun things that kids could do for enjoyment.
I thought of one the other day, and I was like, I've got to remember this. My brain was like, I'm not going to. It was some stupid like 19th century pleasure that completely slipped out of my brain.
All right, and here's New England again.
And thus, alas, your state you much deplore in general terms, but will not say wherefore. What medicine shall I seek to cure this woe, if the wound so dangerous I may not know?
And here's where we get the showing off of historical knowledge.
But you perhaps would have me guess it out. What, hath some Hengist, like that Saxon stout, by fraud or force usurped thy flowering crown? Or by tempestuous wars thy fields trod down? Or hath Canutus, that brave, valiant Dane, the regal, peaceful scepter from thee ta'en? Or is it a Norman, whose victorious hand with English blood bedews thy conquered land? Or is it intestine wars that thus offend? Do Maud and Stephen for the crown contend? Do barons rise and side against their king, and call in foreign aid to help the thing? Must Edward be deposed? Or is it the hour that second Richard must be clapped in the tower? Or is it the fatal jar again begun, that from the red-white pricking roses sprung? Must Richmond's aid the nobles now implore, to come and break the tushes of the boar? If none of these, dear mother, what's your woe? Pray, do you fear Spain's bragging armado? Doth your ally, fair France, conspire your wreck? Or do the Scots play false behind your back? Doth Holland quit you ill for all your love? Whence is the storm, from earth or heaven above? Is it drought, is it famine, or is it pestilence? Dost feel the smart, or fear the consequence? Your humble child entreats you show your grief, though arms nor purse she hath for your relief. Such is her poverty. yet shall be found a suppliant for your help, as she is bound.
A lot of this history, I mean, she would have read Shakespeare, been familiar, I assume, right? And a lot of these things, I can't name all the references for you. British history is not my bag. But yeah, you got a Richard reference in there, the War of Roses, I think.
She circles around the long story of the War of the Roses for the most part.
Norman
invasion. Well, it's interesting to think about that, like, the War of the Roses took place in 1455 to 1485, but the Shakespeare plays, there's like, he did an 8-play cycle on the War of the Roses, and it would have been written in between 1591 and 1599. Which sounds like a long time ago, because it is, but that's like 70, no, just a little over 50 years ago for her.
Right.
So this is like she's generation away from these plays.
Yeah, she's like born in 1612.
Yeah.
So that's like...
At the latter end of Shakespeare's career.
Like, Shakespeare for her is what disco is to us, basically.
Yeah, I was hoping it would be like Larry Bird or something.
I've already expended all of my basketball metaphors for today. So here is we'll get Old England's response here finally. Tell me, even though I can't do anything materially to help you, just tell me what's wrong.
Yeah,
is what the
I like the idea of being like, you've survived so much, and then going after like this, like all these times that England has been embarrassed or screwed itself over.
Yeah, what is it? Every one of the other times you were a complete mess.
You're talking about the time you pissed your pants? No, that's you did
nothing
fine.
To do with that. It's not even a problem anymore. Okay, so here's Old England's response.
I must confess, some of those sores you name my beauteous body at this present maim. But foreign foe nor feigned friend, I fear, for they have work enough, thou knowest, elsewhere. Nor is it Alcee's son, nor Henry's daughter, whose proud contentions cause this slaughter.
And she goes back over a lot of this history, which I think, you know, repeating it just in different words, it to me it suggests the pedagogical learning motive of poetry. Right, like we'll recite this twice, and we'll get it from a couple different angles. It's basically the same story.
Nor noble siding to make John no king, French Louis unjustly to the crown to bring, no Edward, Richard to lose rule and life, nor no Lancastrians to renew old strife, no Duke of York, no Earl of March to soil their hands and kindred's blood whom they did foil, no crafty tyrant now usurps the seat, who nephews slew, that so he might be great. No need of Tudor roses to unite. None knows which is the red or which the white. Spain's braving fleet a second time is sunk. France knows how oft my fury she hath drunk by Edward III and Henry V of fame. Her lilies in my arms avouch the same. My sister Scotland hurts me now no more, though she hath been injurious heretofore. What Holland is, I am in some suspense, but trust not much unto his excellence. For once, sure, some I feel, but more I fear. And for the pestilence, who knows how near? Famine and plague, two sisters of the sword, destruction to a land doth soon afford. There for my punishment ordained on high, unless our tears prevent it speedily. But yet I answer not what you demand, to show the grievance of my troubled land. Before I tell the effect, I'll show the cause, which is my sins, the breach of sacred laws. Idolatry, supplanter of a nation, with foolish, superstitious adoration.
This is, you know, what I mentioned about the sort of habit of the pious to look for what are my sins, which isn't a terrible thing to do, right, when things are going poorly, but not necessarily the place you would necessarily start when you're going through a revolution, for instance, right?
Yeah, I don't care for her analysis, but I do like that impulse, which is like, well, let me tell you about what's so bad right now by telling you how I got here.
Mm-hmm.
That's something that as a country we should probably be doing a lot more of. Just being like, oh God, why did this horrible thing happen to us? Like, well, let's talk about the long list of causes that came before this exact moment.
Yeah, exactly.
Are liked and countenanced by men of might. The gospel trodden down and hath no right. Church offices were sold and bought for gain, that Pope had hoped to find Rome here again. For oaths and blasphemies did ever hear from Beelzebub himself such language hear.
This is not a pro-Catholic poem.
No. It's not that they... It's what I like is that the worst thing that England has done is not that it is Catholic, but that it's kind of Catholic.
Yeah.
Which I can imagine what the worst thing in the world for in Anne Bradstreet's mind is.
I love... church offices are sold and bought again. That Pope had hope to find Rome here again.
It's kind of cute.
Pope had hope to find Rome here again. That is fun. That's a fun... I mean, it wasn't fun to them. Like, to them, it was like murderous religious civil war.
Yeah, and also like he's the devil incarnate.
Yes, coming. Exactly. He's the Antichrist. But the Pope had hope to find Rome again.
Yeah.
Ah, it's a Rome.
What a dope.
In a London. It's a new Rome.
Rome is a bag. It's not...
Back in action in the cell. Right.
What scorning of the saints of the Most High. What injuries did daily on them lie. What false reports, what nicknames did they take, not for their own, but for their master's sake. And thou, poor soul, wert jeered among the rest. Thy flying for the truth was made a jest.
That is the old England saying to New England, yeah, we laughed at you when you were making this huff and puff about how we need to reform and get these papists out. But now, I mean, I guess you were right, so...
Yeah, that this sectarian conflict was obviously because of not renewing the church correctly. Yeah.
Sorry, we jeered at you.
For Sabbath breaking and for drunkenness, did ever land profaneness more express? From crying blood yet cleansed am not I, martyrs and others dying causelessly. How many princely heads on blocks laid down, for naught but title to a fading crown? Amongst all the cruelties by great ones done, O Edward's youths and Clarence's helpless son. O Jane, why didst thou die in flowering prime? Because of royal stem, that was thy crime. For bribery, adultery, and lies, where is the nation I can't paralyze? With usury, extortion, and oppression, these be the hydras of my stout transgression.
There's that hydra imagery I mentioned earlier with the Peter Limbaugh thing. It's kind of fallen off now, but the many-headed hydra was a common... metaphor for describing societal ills.
These be the bitter fountains, heads, and roots, whence flowed the source, the sprigs, the boughs, and fruits. Of more than thou canst hear, or I relate, that with high hand I still did perpetrate. For these were threatened the woeful day. I mocked the preachers, put it far away. The sermons yet upon record do stand that cried destruction to my wicked land. I then believed not, now I feel and see the plague of stubborn incredulity. Some lost their livings, some in prison pent, some fined from house and friends to exile went. Their silent tongues to heaven did vengeance cry. Who saw their wrongs and hath judged righteously, and will repay it sevenfold in my lap? This is forerunner of my afterclap. Nor took I warning by my neighbour's falls. I saw sad Germany's dismantled walls. I saw her people famished, nobles slain, her fruitful land a barren heath remain. I saw unmoved her armies foiled and fled, wives forced, babes tossed, her houses calcined. I saw strong Rochelle yielded to her foe, thousands of starved Christians there also. I saw poor Ireland bleeding out her last, such cruelties as all reports have passed. Mine heart obdurate stood not yet aghast. Now sip I of that cup, and just it may be, the bottom dregs reserved are for me.
All right, and here we have a New England brief response.
To all you've said, sad mother, I assent. Your fearful sins, great cause there is to lament. My guilty hands in part hold up with you.
In part.
Yeah.
My guilty hands, I'm part... Look, I also told you to get it under control, so...
Yeah, she doesn't want to relish in it, but it's important to know that she was right.
I agree, you did sin that much.
Yeah.
A sharer in your punishment's my due. But all you say amounts to this effect, not what you feel, but what you do expect. Pray, in plain terms, what is your present grief? Then let's join heads and hearts for your relief. Well, to the matter, then. There's grown of late 'twixt king and peers a question of state. Which is the chief? The law, or else the king? One said it's he, the other no such thing. 'Tis said my better part in Parliament, to ease my groaning land, showed their intent, to crush the proud and right to each man deal, to help the church and stay the commonweal. So many obstacles came in their way, as puts me to a stand what I should say. Old customs new prerogatives stood on. Had they not held law fast, all had been gone, which by their prudence stood them in such stead. They took high Strafford lower by the head, and to their lord be it spoke they held in the tower, all England's metropolitan that hour. This done, an act they would have passed fain, no prelate should his bishopric retain. Here tugged they hard indeed, for all men saw this must be done by gospel, not by law. Next the militia they urged sore. This was denied, I need not say wherefore.
Now this is basically a brief summary of the English Civil War and how it played out.
The king, displeased, at York himself absents. They humbly beg his return, show their intents. The writing, printing, posting to and fro, show all was done. I'll therefore let it go. But now I come to speak of my disaster. Contention grown 'twixt subjects and their master. They worded it so long, they fell to blows, that thousands lay on heaps. Here bleed my woes. I, that no wars so many years have known, am now destroyed and slaughtered by my own. But could the field alone this strife decide, one battle, two or three I might abide. But these may be beginnings of more woe. Who knows but this may be my overthrow? Oh, pity me in this sad perturbation, my plundered towns, my houses' devastation, my weeping virgins and my young men slain, my wealthy trading fallen, my dearth of grain. The seed time's come, but ploughman hath no hope, because he knows not who shall earn his crop. The poor, they want their pay, their children bread, their woeful mother's tears unpitied. If any pity in thy heart remain, or any childlike love thou dost retain, for my relief do what there lies in thee, and recompense that good I've done to thee.
So those last about 20 lines show, I think, the revolutionary moment in the sort of underclass almost that would, you know, you think of these things as this is Parliament versus the King, right? But that's clearly, as the Linbaugh section I opened with, that's not only what it's about. The line, my wealthy trading fallen, my dearth of grain, the seed time's come, but ploughman hath no hope, because he knows not who shall in his crop. There was an economic problem that happened with the English Civil War because people stopped going to the New World. And that meant that, you know, you don't have anybody to sell your old implements to. You have less laborers coming to help husband more resources. And you know, they're not going to buy your grain. You're going to, if you're expecting to make a return on grain, you're going to want a lot of mouths to feed.
Yeah, and I think for the character of Old England, she had stated before this is a unique problem for her, and she identifies a uniqueness in that it's the first time that England seems to be having an identity crisis. Mm-hmm. It's not so much like an outside invader or the bloodshed of a previous civil war, but it's the idea of like, they don't know, we don't know, I don't know who I am anymore. Which like, it begins with...
A couple battles might be good, but yeah.
Yeah, but this is like, I don't know what's going on anymore. And it's a smart, poetic echo of how it started when not only does she not know who she is anymore, she's not recognizing her own daughter because her daughter had to like plea for her several times, be like, no, I can help you.
Right. Yeah, at least twice. And here's New England's response.
Dear mother, cease complaints and wipe your eyes. Shake off your dust, cheer up, and now arise. You are my mother nurse, and I, your flesh, your sunken bowels gladly would refresh. Your griefs I pity, but soon hope to see out of your troubles much good fruit to be. To see those latter days of hoped-for good, though now beclouded all with tears and blood. After dark popery the day did clear, but now the sun in his brightness shall appear. Blessed be the nobles of thy noble land, with ventured lives for truth's defence that stand. Blessed be thy commons, who for common good and thy infringed laws have boldly stood.
Now that's an interesting point, because one of the key things to know about the colonial period in general is that it coincided with an enclosing of the commons in England. This is partially why a lot of people basically got kicked off of lands, and then they needed to figure out how to, and this is over a course of hundreds of years, but how to make a living without those commons. So those lines sandwiched next to each other, blessed be the nobles of thy noble land, with ventured lives for truth's common defense, or for truth's defense that stand, and then blessed be thy commons, who for common good and thy infringed laws have boldly stood. Like, it's interesting to put those both next to each other, because mm-hmm. those are the high and low classes. But then we see, and I don't know if we're going to get to it soon. Yeah, we are. We're going to get to what the prescription is of Anne, or not of Anne, I guess, of New England. What New England's telling Old England to do. It's maybe not something we would agree with, necessarily.
Yeah, we'll see.
Blessed be thy counties, who did aid thee still with hearts and states to testify their will. Blessed be thy preachers, who do cheer thee on, who cry the sword of God and Gideon. And shall I not on them wish Merah's curse, that help thee not with prayers, with alms and purse? And for myself let miseries abound, if mindless of thy state I e'er be found. These are the days the church's foes to crush, to root out popeling's head, tail, branch, and rush. Let's bring Baal's vestments forth to make a fire, their mitres, surplices, and all their attire, copes, rochets, croziers, and such empty trash, and let their names consume, but let the flash light Christendom, and all the world to see. We hate Rome's whore, with all her trumpery.
So yeah, you got a revolution going on at home. You need to start a war of conquest abroad.
I mean, just completely genocidal, psychotic rant.
And, you know, partially this is because of the expected audience for this poem. It's her father. It's maybe Winthrop. It's leaders of the community, men, the patriarchal leaders of the community. So this isn't going to be like, maybe we shouldn't be, we should be more tolerable. No. Come on, you can't be doing that.
Well, it's interesting also in context of us going over the story of Anne Hutchinson that there seems to be some deflection going on of like you know what the real problem is? Them, over there. Like, get them instead of me being like, you know what's the problem here? Like, the powers that are controlling me. Like, that was Anne Hutchinson's argument. Mm. And Bradstreet's argument is like, we're fine, and if those Catholics can get the fuck out of our faces, maybe we could get something done here.
Go on, brave Essex, with a loyal heart, not false to king, nor to the better part. But those that hurt his people and his crown, as duty binds, expel and tread them down. And ye brave nobles, chase away all fear, and to this hopeful cause closely adhere. O mother, can you weep and have such peers? When they are gone, then drown yourself in tears.
Now, I have a slightly different version of this, and I didn't see anything on differences of version. But there's a line that's missed out after by force expel, destroy and tread them down. She writes, "Let jails be filled with the remnant of that pack, and sturdy Tyburn loaded till it crack." I'm pretty sure Tyburn's a prison. Let me look that up. So very, we need to fill prisons with war.
Till they burst.
Tyburn, I assume it's a prison. Public executions. Sick. So yeah. I'm pretty sure I remember that from the Dunciad actually. Every once in a while, a slight change in wording that makes it may think that maybe Klett is reading from a later one that's been censored a little bit.
If now you weep so much, that then no more the briny ocean will o'erflow your shore. These are they, I trust, with Charles, our king, out of all mists such glorious days shall bring.
It's interesting, she mentions, she's clearly on the side of Parliament, but she mentions the king by name.
Yeah.
I mean, he's dead once this is published, but it wasn't when she was writing it.
Yeah, it is interesting that, but you would assume that she would have, the way she's laid it out, she would align her cause with Cromwell, who's the Puritan movement by nature, but it... She seems to, I don't know, I had trouble parsing that. What did you think about that, that she clearly lays fealty to the sovereign?
Well, I think she plays lip service to the sovereign. And and actually there's a censored line that's different from when the Clet read, and that will, I think, make clear which side she's really on.
Yeah.
Like she is ultimately on Parliament's side, blaming, you know, exercise, the way she talks about the king's exercise in a parl, she's less explicit about it being Charles until later here, but I think she is on the side of Parliament, and Parliament was the anti popish side.
Eyes beholding much shall wonder at that thy settled peace, thy wealth and splendor, thy church.
Okay, so this is her describing what it's going to be like after they win all with it, after they vanquish all these enemies.
Are the briny ocean will o'erflow your shore. These are they, I trust, with Charles, our king, out of all mists such glorious days shall bring, that dazzled eyes beholding much shall wonder at that thy settled peace, thy wealth and splendor, thy church and weal established in such manner that all shall joy that thou displayedst thy banner.
Here we get some criminal justice reform.
And discipline erected so, I trust, that nursing king shall come and lick thy dust. Then justice shall in all thy courts take place, without respect of person or of case. Then bribe shall cease, and suit shall not stick long. Patience and purse of clients oft to wrong. Then high commissions shall fail to decay, and pursuivants and catchpoles want their pay.
So Clet fucks that up. The actual line, at least according to the version I have here, then high commissions shall fall to decay, not fail to decay. And pursuivants and catchpoles want their prey. So basically, like she's saying, prisons and courts should go broke because we don't use them. We don't need to use them because everything's just.
Well, yeah, we're a brotherhood of Puritans at this point. We don't. Wow, that no one Puritan would cheat another.
Yep. But we're not just on the kumbaya, everything's going to be fine, because immediately after this, she goes back to the, let's get those fucking Romans, though.
Yeah.
So shall thy happy nation ever flourish, when truth and righteousness they thus shall nourish. When thus in peace thine armies brave send out to sack proud Rome and all her vassals rout, there let thy name, thy fame and glory shine, as did thine ancestors in Palestine.
I mean, what the fuck?
Palestine's been a target for a while.
It's so alien to be like, let's do two things. One, get rid of prison. Two, invade Rome. It's like, what?
And take all their shit.
Yeah, fucking kill them all. And then finally, we'll have a good, normal-ass Europe.
And let her spoils full pay with interest be of what unjustly once she palled from thee. Of all the woes thou canst let her be sped, and on her pour the vengeance threatened. Bring forth the beast that ruled the world with his beck, and tear his flesh, and set your feet on his neck, and make his filthy den so desolate, to the astonishment of all that knew his state. This done, with brandished swords to Turkey go, for then what is it but English blades dare do, and lay her waste, for so's the sacred doom, and do to Gog as thou hast done to Rome. O Abraham, seed, lift up your heads on high, for sure the day of your redemption's nigh. The scales shall fall from your long-blinded eyes, and him you shall adore whom now despise. Then fullness of the nations in shall flow, and Jew and Gentile to one worship go. Then follow days of happiness and rest, whose lot doth fall to live therein is blessed. No Canaanite shall then be found in the land, and holiness on horses' bells shall stand. If this make way thereto, then sigh no more, but if at all thou didst not see it before. Farewell, dear mother, rightest cause prevail, and in a while you'll tell another tale.
Those last two lines, I have different ones. Farewell, dear mother, Parliament prevail, and in a while you'll tell another tale.
Interesting.
So yeah, the version I have here is actually more, throws a bit more bombs. There's a few other that I didn't...
Was that on Poetry Foundation's website?
This is the University of Toronto.
Oh, that's the one. I think the one I was reading and took notes on was the one that she's reading.
Oh, was it?
Yeah.
Interesting. So if anybody, I'll keep an eye open because I don't think we're done with Bradstreet, but I'd be curious if anybody knows what the differences in those versions are.
I have to say, pleasantly surprised considering the time that this was written, when she's going on a megalomaniacal tear and she's like, we're going to blow up Rome, we're going to go to the Ottoman Empire, destroy them too, and then she's like, and the Jews, and it's like, oh God, like, here we go. And basically saying they'll convert peaceably is the best case scenario,
yeah.
Considering her contemporaries be like, and we've saved the worst for you, my friend.
Yeah. I just want to play one final clip from Mistress Bradstreet. I think you should buy this book. If you're interested in this episode, I and want a sense of colonial Massachusetts, this is one of the better things I've read.
Anne understood all too well the resentment that often lies between mothers and daughters. At last, New England dispenses with the customary reverence that children are supposed to feel toward parents and takes over the poem with a shocking ferocity. The daughter's final speech outlines what Old England would have to do, with New England's help, to save herself from destruction. These are the days the church's foes to crush. To root out Popeling's head, tail, branch, and rush. Thine armies brave send out. To sack proud Rome and all her vassals rout. Bring forth the beast that ruled the world with speck. And tear his flesh and set your feet on's neck. This done, with brandished swords to Turkey go. For then what is tea but English blades dare do? And lay her waste for so's the sacred doom. Truly, this was Dudley's daughter writing. Anne poured all of her pent-up anger and fear about the current political situation into these stanzas. England could save herself only through righteous warfare against the infidel, and the enemy was everywhere: Rome, Turkey, Palestine. It was not enough for England to redeem herself and purify her own church and state. She would have to launch herself into the world to spread the true beliefs of the dissenter and vanquish the idolatries of all other faiths. A manuscript version of this poem was probably passed among the friends of the Bradstreet Dudley clan long before it was published. If so, Anne's words about the righteousness of New England would have gratified her fellow New World Puritans who had chosen not to return to England to fight the king. Such men could read her poem and feel that they had chosen the right side in the conflict. Not until England had purged herself of her sin and corruption should her colony feel impelled to help her. Those who remained in New England could see themselves as righteous instead of cowardly. An astute reader could also have seen that Anne was firmly on the side of Parliament, a dangerous position for a colonial to assert. Although she qualified her attack on Charles by saying that anyone who was false to king or who hurt his crown should be expelled, she was also blunt about which side was England's better part. It was Parliament who showed their intent, / to crush the proud, / to help the church. Indeed, in Anne's poem Charles seems sulky rather than wise. The king, displeased, at York himself absence, and he blocks Parliament's attempts at righting England's wrongs. This was an exciting poem to read, packed as it was with bloodshed, predictions of the future, and a long, exhilarating recital of the monarchy's sins. Though it seemed aimed at a larger audience than any of her previous poems, Anne did not know how it would be received by others. No other New Englander, male or female, had written such political verse about the Civil War. Not only had she trespassed into male territory with this kind of political poetry, but she also condemned the king. When at last she copied it out onto paper and sent a dialogue between Old England and New to her father and ward, she waited with trepidation to hear what they thought. Fortunately for Anne, there is no record of either man criticizing her ambition. Instead, both appear to have been thrilled. A dialogue articulated important ideals that were close to the hearts of New England leaders. Later Ward would gloat that she had surpassed all other writers, including men, declaring, "Let men look to tea, lest women wear the spurs." With the approval of these two important mentors, Anne's confidence could only soar. While she loved her husband, it was Ward's and Dudley's opinions that mattered most when it came to her work, and she had an agenda now. Anne wanted to write in the pithy, plain voice of her new home, and she wanted to add her opinions to the ongoing political debate. In other words, with a dialogue she announced her intention to be a sort of pundit, a public commentator, she was intent on joining the larger world of debate and ideas, one traditionally closed to women. To do this, she would have to...
Anne Bradstreet, not only our first poet in America, but the first woman pundit.
Yeah, I couldn't help but feel an eerie sense of foreshadowing when she goes on that tirade. If she really is a representation of, if she's attempting to be a representation of this new colony, mm-hmm. to, it's basically America telling England, like, you got to snap out of this identity crisis, and I will show you, like, the kind of nation that you should have been, which is this one that just exports murder and destruction and imperial force around the world.
Right. And it's interesting that, you know, we're still very much in the 17th century. But that outward sort of, it would become an empire of liberty like 120 such years ago, right? Like the American Revolution had secularized slightly in the 18th century. America had a little bit. Partially, I think, because of the excesses of Massachusetts Bay Colony and the witch trials and just the general enlightenment. But the same outward-looking posture of, we got these swords and these ideas, mm-hmm. and you want these, right?
Yeah.
we're going to give them to you anyway. Yeah, that it is, it's amazing how it's just that.
There's something, it's almost primal, like buried into like American DNA. It's reductive, but when you read a poem like this of like, the urge to leave the old world and start something new is the flip side of the urge to go back and demolish it, almost.
Right. Interesting. Yeah. And which impulse do you give into? And how do you justify giving into one versus the other?
Yeah.
And that's what Americans had to, throughout all this time, justify. Like, oh, all that shit's going on over there. Pretty crazy stuff going on over here too, and yeah. We have like what, like a couple of weeks for communication between the two.
Yeah.
There you go, Anne Bradstreet. Let's plug Patreon. If you haven't supported the show yet, go to patreon.com/literaryhangover and give us some money every month. That would be very helpful. Alex is at @ALECKS. Guns? Underscore guns.
Yeah.
I'm at Matt Leck. Thank you again, Alex. I very much appreciate your joining me today.
Yeah, it was a good one. I'm glad that Anne Bradstreet is in my life now.
Yeah, because you're more the poetry guy.
Yeah, yeah. So it's doubly shameful.
Yeah. I think we'll probably maybe do some more Bradstreet. You know, she doesn't, she wrote a lot, but her published work.
A lot sucked.
Yeah, a lot of it's trash. just garbage. What'd you think of in terms of the form? Is it boring compared to, tell listeners what your main poetry reading is and how that sort of set you up for reading Bradstreet here.
Hew to the modernist poets, and within the modernist poets, the paleo-modernists, so the ones that steep themselves in classical references and stuff like that. So not too far off, actually. They would have been imitating with a little bit more direct style what Bradstreet is attempting here.
Right. Because for a while in this, Mistress Bradstreet talks about how she was written off as sort of boring. Mm-hmm. Unless you think all poetry is boring, I don't know what exactly they're talking about there.
Yeah, considering her era was a particularly rigid, well, that's not necessarily true, but she's the great poet to compare her to, he would have been versifying about 10 years after her, would be Milton. Mm. And I can't help, but there's some serious parallels going on. I know a good amount about Milton. I don't think that, there's any reference to him reading her, mm-hmm. but they definitely were thinking of the revolution going on in England through cosmic terms and revolutionary political terms. They both seem to be, they're like twins almost, mm-hmm. in that way. I would say Milton executed his project slightly better, but he also had way more time and way more money. So,
and didn't have to be afraid of being like exiled and called a witch.
Well, he was exiled. He worked for Parliament.
Right. Is this revolve to do with Areopagitica, or is that a different tale? We should probably just do Milton sometime.
We'll do him later.
Well, on that note, Alex, again, thank you very much for joining me.
Oh, great.
And we will be back next time on Literary Hangover.